This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with pollster, commentator, and columnist Ron Fauché. He'll review the political winds of 2018 and look ahead to the governor's election in 2019 as Governor John Bel Edwards seeks re-election. Also, Lady Hubbard, she is this year's recipient of the Ernest Gaines Writing Award. There'll be a ceremony Thursday night at the Manship Theater, and she'll talk about her work, and she's also a professor at Tulane. And Fairleigh Jackson on the partnership with the Preserve Louisiana and the Louisiana International Film Festival. We'll hear from Peggy McDonald. Now the news on WRKF. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Cabochon is producing, and your number is 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, outside the area, 877-217-5757. You can also reach us by email at talk@talklouisiana.org. We're pleased to begin our show today with Lady Hubbard. She is the Ernest Gaines Writing Award recipient for this year, and there will be a grand ceremony on Thursday night at the Manship Theater, the 11th annual award. And Lady is somebody who is familiar with these parts. She teaches at Tulane University, and the book that she is being recognized for is The Talented Ribkins. We visited with her last year, and she is back again to talk about her book and her work. Toni Morrison says, for sheer reading pleasure, Lady Hubbard's original and wildly inventive novel is in a class by itself. And good morning to you, Lady Hubbard. It's nice to see you again.
Oh, good morning.
Well, this is quite an honor.
Yes, it is.
Anybody who is familiar with Ernest Gaines has to have an affinity for his writing, and the fact that this award is named after him and that he will be there, I'm sure, adds to the luster.
Absolutely. No, I'm really honored to have received this award for my first book. It's wonderful.
What is it about the writing process that attracts you? And, of course, this particular book is one that I think has relevance for many people in all walks of life.
Well, I've always written. I've always enjoyed writing. It's always been a really important outlet for me to express myself and the things that I think and feel. So I was thinking that actually a lot of the book really is about recognizing your unique talent and learning to value your unique talents and appreciate them even if other people do not. So it's sort of, you could think of it as like it's about when there's something you're very passionate about, disrespecting that and taking it seriously.
Well, Lady Hubbard, for those unfamiliar, is somebody who came here from another place. She has a BA from Princeton, an MFA in dramatic writing from NYU, and an MFA in creative writing from the University of Wisconsin, and a PhD from UCLA. Mm-hmm. So you have been around the country, and now you live in New Orleans. How is it being in the crown jewel of Louisiana, the city that is most famous for our state and one of the most famous in the world? How is that as far as the creative process?
Oh my gosh, New Orleans is a wonderful place to live if you're an artist or a creative person. I am constantly inspired by living there. It's such a there's so many creative people. There's so much creative energy, and I feel like I really do feed off of that. So I'm glad that I made my way to New Orleans, and it is definitely now my home.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I'm sure, the first of a few novels. You're not going to stop with this one.
No.
Is there something in the works right now?
I'm working on it. It's a historical novel. It's not really a prequel, but it involves the story of the main character of this, The Talented Ribkins, is Johnny Ribkins. So what I've been working on lately is a historical novel, and his grandfather is a character in it.
At 72, Johnny Ribkins shouldn't have the kinds of problems he has. He's got 1 week to come up with money he stole from his mobster boss or its curtains. And what may or may not be useful to Johnny as he flees is that he comes from an African-American family that has been gifted with superpowers that are a bit odd. How odd?
Well, yeah, they're talents. They refer to what they have as talents. So, and in part, the idea for that was a reference to the Du Bois essay, The Talented Tenth. And in the book, they're sort of physicalized. I wanted to make the idea of talent a tangible thing. So one of them can see in the dark. One can scale any wall. One can catch anything that's thrown at her. And the main character, Johnny, can make maps of any landscape he passes through. He can make perfect maps.
Well, in the old days, the Ribkins family tried to apply their gifts to the civil rights effort, calling themselves the Justice Committee. But when their superpowers were insufficient, the group fell apart. And out of frustration, Johnny and his brother used their talents to stage a series of burglaries, each more daring than the last. Obviously, you have a vivid imagination, Lady Hubbard.
Yes, I mean, I think so. Johnny, the character Johnny, he's 72 when the book starts, and he has spent most of his life up through when he was part of this group, the Justice Committee, trying to figure out how to use his talent for map making for good. And it's actually always sort of fallen short of what he had hoped, and then he tries something else. And so I think that the failure of the Justice Committee was kind of the he just became very disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. did the Ribkins come into your mind and your heart, and ultimately on the printed page?
It draws upon a lot of different things. On a more abstract level, I was really interested in sort of the traditional Southern African American middle class and the idea of talent in The Talented Tenth, the essay written by Du Bois, and sort of how that has affected people's perceptions of the black middle class, and also how the black middle class perceives itself. On a more personal level, a lot of the main characters are drawn from my own experience, my family members, and other people that inspired or influenced me growing up. So a lot of the personality of the characters is actually drawing upon people I knew when I was younger, who inspired me and I, you know, were my childhood heroes in a sense.
Lady Hubbard is the person we're speaking with, a professor of African studies at Tulane. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. I'm told this was inspired by an essay that was written in 1903. Mm-hmm. So you went back a few years.
Yeah, I did. So it's an essay by W.E.B. Du Bois called The Talented Tenth. And it was written about the need for educational opportunities, that they should be made available to African Americans in the South at that time. And he was talking specifically about a liberal arts education. And his argument in that essay was that there was a tenth of the population that was sort of endowed with the natural talent or ability to become the leadership class, and that they just needed to be trained and educated. And so that term has had a very profound cultural impact, I think. And I also think it's really important, and it comes up in, you know, its own ways in the book, that that he was specific. It was written in a specific context, and that he actually was trying to make an argument for a specific audience to allocate funds so that, you know, African Americans would have an opportunity to receive a liberal arts education in the South.
Quite frequently on the show, we talk about race, class, and politics, and your book incorporates all of those.
Yeah. Yes, it does. So,
well, it's not an easy hat trick, but you've pulled it off, and this is a compelling story, and it's an entertaining story.
Well, thank you.
Sometimes it's difficult to have both of those ingredients in the same book.
Well, thank you.
Well, the mentor for you is not just any mentor. I mentioned that Toni Morrison wrote a glowing review of your book, but she also had a big effect on your writing, and you knew her at Princeton, correct?
Yes, yes.
How was your relationship with her?
It was really wonderful, and the fact that she was at Princeton, it might have been the only reason that I want. I mean, it really inspired me to want to go there. I really idolized her. After I read her books, I was just so inspired, and I really wanted to meet her. And then, you know, I really wanted to work with her. So I feel very fortunate that I was finally able to do that. And ultimately, she was my thesis advisor while I was there. So that was great.
And sometimes having somebody that acclaimed, those are difficult shoes to fill. Was it a bit intimidating?
It definitely was intimidating. And I don't think that I graduated thinking like, oh, well, now I will go and be Toni Morrison. So I really wasn't thinking about things like that. I was just so honored to be in her presence and have the opportunity to actually have her comment on my work.
We're visiting with Lady Hubbard. Her book is The Talented Ribkins, and Lady will be honored Thursday night, winning the Ernest Gaines Award, and we'll talk more with her after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. 877-217-5757 is your number. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with Lady Hubbard, a professor of African studies at Tulane. As mentioned, a varied educational background, having degrees from Princeton, NYU, UCLA, and Wisconsin. And at Princeton, she was mentored by the Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison. She, Lady Hubbard, is the recipient of the 2018 Ernest Gaines Award. Actually, I think it's technically the 2017 winner, but she will be honored January 18th, as in Thursday, at the Manship Theater, the 11th annual event, and it is always a huge event, and if you'd like to be on hand, it'll be at 6:30 Thursday, Manship Theater at the Shaw Center for the Arts, free and open to the public, but reservations are requested at gainsaward@braf.org. That's gainsaward@braf.org. And you'll be reading from The Talented Ribkins, will you not?
Yes, I will.
Have you decided which passage you'll be reading from?
No, I'm still thinking about that. So be a surprise.
Well, you're a professor as well and a writer. How do you bridge the responsibilities from those passions in your life?
Well, I'm not, I've taught off and on at Tulane, since 2002, actually, but I'm not, a tenured professor there. So I only do that part time. I also have three children, which, is also a very time consuming, undertaking.
How old are they?
One is 5, one is 12, and one is 17.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you do have some responsibilities, and it is hard to be with three children when you're not working, but you're doing it a lot. As far as the writing process, when do you usually compose? When do you, and how often do you do it? Do you write every day?
I write every day, and I wake up at 5 in the morning every day in order to do that before I have to get people dressed and out the door and off to school and things like that, so...
You've lived in many places in this country, on the East Coast, the West Coast, and I guess for all intents, the Midwest, if we count Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now the South. How is this region different, if at all, from the others you've lived?
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Well, they're all very, very... different. So it's hard to even talk about because I spent a lot of time in Florida growing up, which is it's the South, but it's certainly really different from New Orleans. I feel like New Orleans is such a unique place that it's kind of hard to compare it to anywhere else that I've it just feels very singular and specific unto itself. So it's the South, but it's definitely its own version, distinct version of the South, right?
Right. That's true. It's, mm-hmm. it's a distinct city in many ways, and mm-hmm. that brings us to a question from a listener. This is Lonnie asking about the monuments coming down in New Orleans. Was your perception regarding what was one of the big stories of 2017?
Oh, I thought it was about time. I was very happy to see that. There are a whole lot of things that could have monuments to them. So for me, I was very proud of my city for doing that, honestly.
It is a decision I'm sure that many supported, and as we know, some opposed. Mm-hmm. But now that it's been done, it doesn't appear that there is any major residual problem, and that's a testament to the people of New Orleans. But I'm sure you can understand that even many who find the Civil War abhorrent and the reasons for it terrible, those monuments are part of history. What about the contention that it's hard to erase history?
There's so much that could be memorialized in terms of documenting the Civil War that is not. So I don't think it's erasing history at all. The lot happened in New Orleans during the Civil War. There's a whole lot that I think could be represented and might be sort of more representative of the values of the city itself than that.
Well, there's any number of people who could replace those monuments.
Mm-hmm.
You have some ideas?
Yeah. someone was talking to me about putting up Ellen Toussaint statue would be really great. There's just a lot. I think there's a lot that could be commemorated. There's an awful lot of history that could be commemorated and deserves commemoration that isn't, right? Culturally,
sure.
Politically, socially. It is history, but there's lots of different ways to remember it. I was very happy that happened.
New Orleans has a rich literary history.
It sure does, yeah.
Some great writers of fiction and now some of nonfiction. Walter Isaacson and Michael Lewis are among those who are tearing the world apart today. But when you look back at people like Truman Capote, who spent a lot of time in New Orleans, Tennessee Williams, William Faulkner, it's a city that seems to attract artistic people.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you've been there a while, and as mentioned, you've lived in Los Angeles, you lived on the East Coast, not far from New York. You did live in New York. We were at NYU. Being in cities that some consider the center of the universe, how does it compare living in New Orleans, where you've been for some time?
How does New Orleans compare to other cities?
Mm-hmm. And being in such large metropolitan areas, do you feel like you're flourishing by being in New Orleans?
That's really interesting. It's not a big city, but I guess in terms of population, but there's always a lot going on. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I get a lot out of living there. It's not the easiest place to live, but I certainly have, I appreciate being there. And I feel like I've gained an awful lot from the experience of it. So it's a complicated city. Very complicated as well.
City, yeah. High crime, and as is Baton Rouge.
Mm.
And we've noted that the three cities with the highest HIV rate, one is Baton Rouge and three is New Orleans.
Mm.
So we've got a lot of issues. But amid that, our people, if polls are accurate, are among the happiest in the world. And I suspect it's largely because of the culture that you mentioned a moment ago. There's a lot of good things amid the bad things.
Yeah, there always is, though. But New Orleans is particularly rich. I think people have found really I think it's inspiring sort of the creative responses that people have managed to forge, and the creative traditions that people have managed to forge out of difficulty. That in and of itself is really a testament to the human spirit, I would say, because that's part of, I think, sort of the give and take. It's definitely not like a perfect place, but it is very inspiring in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we had Ernest Gaines on this show yesterday, and his latest work is The Tragedy of Brady Sims, which is a novella set in New Orleans in the 1940s during the Great Migration, and he, of course, wrote the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and The Gathering of Old Men, A Lesson Before Dying, some of the real classics, all of which have a Louisiana theme. And the fact that you're getting this award that bears his name, I'm sure adds not only to the luster of getting it, but also the fact that here's a guy who has expressed living in Louisiana and the challenges, particularly of people of color, like nobody else. Tell you what, we're going to pause. That music is a sign that we are. So Lady is thinking about Ernest J. Gaines, who will be on hand Thursday night with her to receive, as the lady receives the 11th annual Ernest Gaines Award. And we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana right here on 89.3 WRKF after this news break on a chilly day with Karen Henderson.
Louisiana Radio Network News, I'm Michelle Southern. A strong cold front's moved through North Louisiana into central Louisiana this morning and hitting the bottom half of the state by this afternoon. Kent Kuiper with the National Weather Service in Lake Charles says this winter weather has been crazy this season.
December 15th or sometime around then, that's when the storm started coming in, and we've had almost a month of this stuff. Canadian cold air, Arctic air coming in straight in, and this is straight Arctic air coming at us.
Shreveport's already seen about 3 inches of snow in some areas. The cold, sleet, freezing rain and wintry mix is expected to move south throughout the day. The Department of Transportation says there are ice over many roads in North Louisiana. I-49 closed, so is I-220, and many bridges in the Shreveport area. There are several overpasses closed on I-20 in northeast Louisiana. Officials encourage those who have to travel the state today to check 511LA.org for a complete and updated list of road closures or blockages. Winter weather advisories are posted for the entire state. Louisiana Radio Network.
This is Attorney General Jeff Landry asking for your help to root out Medicaid welfare fraud. Welfare fraud takes resources from those who need it and steals from taxpayers, whether it's those who acquire unneeded prescription drugs, falsely bill, or lie to gain eligibility. All welfare fraud is wrong. If you know of people using the Medicaid program to obtain money, services, or drugs they're not entitled to, report it. Call 888-799-6885 or visit agjefflandry.com.
This is Trace Atkins for the Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation. It's a brand new year, and here at Farm Bureau, we're going to make one promise for this year: to watch out for Louisiana farmers and ranchers every single day. You have enough to worry about with getting a crop planted and getting those new baby calves on the ground this spring. You shouldn't have to deal with government regulations and crazy laws that tell you how to farm. That's why you have Farm Bureau, the Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation, the voice of Louisiana agriculture.
Governor John Bel Edwards is making a final push to negotiate a fiscal cliff deal before a self-imposed January 19th deadline.
So far, negotiations between Edwards and GOP House leadership have been unproductive. Edwards hoped to have an agreement in principle on plugging the billion-dollar budget hole by Friday so that he can call a February special session to pass some sort of tax reform legislation. The governor is not a fan of putting off talks until after the regular session is completed.
We'll be coming back in June in the last 3 weeks to fix the cliff, pass a budget, pass capital outlay, and you're prone to make mistakes.
I'm Jeff Palermo.
163 employees at CB&I in Livingston Parish are losing their jobs. The pipe fabrication facility in Walker says they're cutting costs due to the lack of available work. The business report says the decision was made after the company announced a $6 billion merger with McDermott International. The layoffs go into effect February 19th. Michelle Southern on LRN.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. We're visiting for a few more minutes with Lady Hubbard. She is the recipient of this year's Ernest J. Gaines Award. And the ceremony is set for Thursday night, 6:30 at the Manship Theater. And the Gaines Award's a nationally acclaimed $10,000 annual prize created by the Baton Rouge Area Foundation donors to recognize outstanding work from rising African-American fiction writers while honoring Ernest Gaines' extraordinary contribution to the literary world. And as we paused a moment ago, I mentioned some of the magnificent works of Ernest J. Gaines and his long career, which now spans more than a half century on the printed page. And they're all about Louisiana, with a few notable exceptions. And I would think that his work has been an inspiration to you, lady.
Yes, it has. And I was thinking about this morning. One of the things that, just to the representation of sort of African-American, Southern, rural life, right, in Louisiana. And one of the things that I was struck with, and I think that was actually really was something I was trying to do in my novel, was just the complexity, trying to show the complexity of community, to represent a community, a Black community, in a really complicated way. And there are a lot of different family members in my book, and they're all really different. They don't all have the same opinions about things. They have horrible arguments, but ultimately they are still a family, right? They still represent a community. And so I think that's very real, and I think it's important that that complexity is represented. It certainly meant a lot to me, and it's something I felt was very important to write about in this book as well.
You plan on staying in Louisiana a while?
I do.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and for those who'd like to meet this exceptional person, Lady Hubbard, you can do so Thursday night, and she will read from her book, The Talented Ripkins, which has received outstanding reviews. And it's not an easy process getting your work published. I would imagine it was quite an odyssey.
It was indeed.
How did it happen?
Well, I was publishing, I was writing a lot of short stories while I was teaching at Tulane. And actually the first chapter of this book was a short story that I published several years ago. And I just kept thinking about the characters, and I wanted to explore their story more. And so I figured out a way to be able to just sit and write for 2 years, and I was able to finish it.
How did you learn that you had won the award?
A phone call. Yeah.
Was it a surprise?
It was absolutely a surprise. And again, it's an extraordinary honor. I was aware of the award before I'd even written my novel. So, it was a wonderful surprise.
Okay, and I have a question from a listener that you may or may not want to address. This one from Emily, asking your thoughts about the level of discourse in the age of the new president, and then the new president who in 4 days will have 1 year in office, Donald John Trump. What do you think about the way we're addressing each other and the level of discourse in the year that he has been the leader of the free world?
The level of discourse, that's an interesting way to put that question, the level of discourse. I think a lot of the discourse has been really, in terms of, if you're talking about the president, sort of unbelievably crass. I'm often just shocked by I'm sure a lot of people are, just sort of the crassness of it. I really hope people reflect on that a little bit and just sort of think about sort of the image that is currently being put out in the world in terms of how we treat other people and what that says about this country, how people are talked about. I'm pretty appalled by it myself, so I don't know what else to.
Well,
in terms of specific phrasing of that question, I'm trying to figure out what, because it is a little bit vague.
He's a guy who says what he thinks and tells people what he thinks of them. Mm-hmm. And then when people tell him what they think of him, he generally doesn't like it if it's not calling him a genius. So is this point of view and the way of life for him has worked for him. He is the president. Do you think others will emulate him and have the same style as far as basically just saying whatever's on your mind without any hesitation about whether it is appropriate or not?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it seems as though some people are sort of emulating that example or feeling more free to sort of express themselves in that way. And I don't know. I keep hoping that it will make other people think about whether or not they would want to. Like, what does that actually mean? I mean, there are ethics, mm-hmm. really, and there are, you know, I mean, I don't know what to say about the level of discourse at this current moment in terms of that. It's not something I would personally aspire to, and it's a bit mystifying why anyone would aspire to that. So I think that's I hope there's a lot of reflection right now.
Well, I appreciate your candor,
okay.
and since we've gotten into the political realm and the story, what about all the sexual harassment stories that are emanating in all walks of life? This is certainly a new day.
Right. Well, maybe that is a manifestation of the kind of reflection I'm talking about. It is a very interesting and fraught cultural moment, and I don't know, maybe they are all sort of related, right? The fact that there is all this talk about things that have not really been talked about for a very long time. And realizing that, you know, this needs a lot of things that have been going on for a while probably need to be addressed openly and honestly.
Well, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Lady, you've been a good sport talking about some things that are not featured in The Talented Ripkins.
No.
But your book is noted. It has themes that involve all aspects of our life, including race and class and politics. And it is a good read, and we appreciate you telling us about what got you to this place. And come Thursday, she'll be with Ernest Gaines, 6:30, Manship Theater, for the 11th Annual Ernest James Gaines Award for Literary Excellence.
All right,
good
thank
to see
you.
And we're joined in studio now by Peggy Sweeney McDonald. She is worn a few hats in our community, but her latest is that she is heading up the Louisiana International Film Festival. And April 19th, just 3 months and 3 days away, it opens.
Yes, we're on the it's time to get ready for the film festival. So I'm very excited to be a part of it. I'm the new managing director, and a perfect fit moving back from Los Angeles and finding this great job working with Chesley, the executive director. And we have a lot of exciting things planned, and it's just going to be fabulous. It'll be back at Cinemark Perkins Row, and we are still taking submissions from filmmakers. So everybody needs to submit their film and hopefully make plans to come on out. Our website is taking – they can get all the information to take to submit their film at lifilmfest.org. And we also have our big Sundance party coming up. If they're going to be in Sundance, please go to our website and – RSVP, it's a big networking event called Mardi Gras Muses this year, and it's a true celebration of Louisiana with Louisiana food, Louisiana music, lots of beads and masks, and it's just going to be fabulous at Park City Live on Friday the 26th of January.
Well, it's going to be quite a next few months, but have you come to the grips with who's going to be featured in the 4 days of the film festival?
Not yet. We haven't made any announcements yet, but that will be coming soon. And, you know, it's always – I got to go last year. I just got an all-access pass for 4 days, and I went by myself because, of course, Jimmy was golfing over the weekend. Mm-hmm. But I went, and I was so impressed, not only with the level of films. I mean, I saw some really great films that probably wouldn't play in Baton Rouge normally. I saw some really great international films and some great shorts, especially all the Louisiana short films, and some great documentaries, including Commanding the Table, the Ella Brennan, which was so wonderful, and they did a great Q&A after with Lally Brennan and her daughter, Ella Brennan's daughter. So that was such a treat. And I went to some of the events, the evening party, and saw a lot of friends that I knew and met some new friends. And so I'm so glad I went, because a few months later, I ended up getting this job. And so I haven't worked on a film festival, so it's been quite a learning curve. I've learned a lot, and I still have a lot more to learn as we, you know, are in the final stretch to kick off the film festival in April.
Well, it's less than 100 days away, so you're going to be in full gear, and you mentioned you're going to Sundance.
Yes, I leave next Tuesday on the 23rd.
So what benefits do you get by going to what is known as one of the great independent film festivals in the world?
Well, you know, LIFF, the Louisiana International Film Festival, is the only film festival that has an event at the Sundance Film Festival. Mm-hmm. So this is the sixth year, and I've never been to the Sundance Film Festival, and I'm very excited. The party that we do, it's this huge networking event, and it's for filmmakers. You know, we invite all, within 24 hours, less than 24 hours, we had over 500 RSVPs. It's a really popular hot ticket. Everybody wants to be at the Louisiana event because we know how to party, right? We know how to have a good time, and it's just a great way for filmmakers from all over the world to get together and find out about coming to Louisiana for our film festival in April.
Well, we'll spend a few more minutes with Peggy Sweeney McDonald. Your number is 877-217-5757, and we're back after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. Peggy Sweeney McDonald with us for a few more minutes. And many of us remember when she was doing her Back at Café Du Monde series, traveling the state and a whole bunch of places, talking about food and restaurants and our culture. But she has now embraced a new endeavor as the head of the Louisiana International Film Festival. She is partnering with Chesley Himesfield, who's been with us many times. And now one of your partners in this new project is Preserve Louisiana. What's going on next month?
So when I moved back from Louisiana, from L.A. to Louisiana, back to Baton Rouge, where I'm from, Fairley and I reached out to each other, and she wanted to do these tours that Preserve Louisiana had rebranded from the Foundation for Historical Louisiana. And they used to do these Lagniappe tours, and they had stopped doing them. And since she had rebranded, she wanted to do them and bring them back. And so she said, "Would you like to work with me on them?" And I said, "I'd love to." And I said, "I would love to do these tours." And the first one we planned was last January to Natchez. But I told her, I said, "I don't want to just be the host of the tour. I would like to do the Meanwhile Back at Café Du Monde show wherever we go with local foodies." So in Natchez, we had all these amazing foodies, including Regina Charbonneau's, the Cookbook Arthur, and Darby's of Darby's famous fudge. So we did the dinner the second night at Dunleith Plantation and had this wonderful dinner with these great food stories from local people. So it was like the Natchez Meanwhile Back at Café Du Monde. And now we're going to Cajun Land. This is the second tour. It's February 16th to 18th. 10 people who were on the last tour have already registered, so that's shows that it's so much fun. Everybody had a blast. So we're going to be leaving on Friday morning from the old Governor's Mansion, and we're going to be going to Tabasco, Shadows on the Tesh, Rip Van Winkle Gardens, and having fabulous dinners, right, including the original Landry's Cajun dancing.
For those who'd like more information, what's the best way to reach you, Peggy?
The best way to go to Preserve Louisiana's website, and they can register there. It's a two-night, three-day tour, and it's really reasonable and includes everything. So I hope they'll join us, because it's going to be a lot of fun discovering the culture of Cajun land.
Well, we thank you for joining us as always, and we look forward to seeing you come festival time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
And unfortunately, Ron Fauché will not be able to be with us today, but we are joined in our remaining time by a fascinating gentleman, Amir Hussein, and he is an expert on artificial intelligence, the revolution which is upon us. And it is a pleasure to talk with you, Amir. Thank you for being on the show.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And The book is about the coming age of artificial intelligence, and you are considered an expert and an inventor. What's your background on this?
So, Jim, you know, I've been in the software industry for many years, since I was a very young boy. I became interested in computers and software, and that sort of became my life passion, and that drove my career and everything that I did. In my teens, I became very interested in artificial intelligence and actively became involved with research, published some papers. And from there on, it just grew. The interest and the potential of what we could do with this technology just took a hold of me. And I came to Austin back in 1996 to pursue computer science at UT Austin. I was in the PhD program, dropped out, and started a venture-funded startup company, and then did several more, and some of them got acquired. And back in 2013, I started Spark Cognition, which is an Austin, Texas-based AI company. It's focused on cutting-edge artificial intelligence applications in finance, in military, and also in industry. So that's just a brief 40 seconds on how I got here.
Well, Amir, this is affecting us in dramatic ways now, but is it going to pick up more steam and become a more pervasive part of our world as the years go by?
Jim, I think there's no doubt that that is the case. You know, there's an international competition, almost one can call it, that's already taking hold. You may have seen that Vladimir Putin, not too long ago, issued a statement that he who controls artificial intelligence will control the world. Russia's investments in AI are significant, and they're focused on not just commercial applications, but also military applications. The Chinese government recently issued a report, and in fact, an outline for a strategy whereby by the year 2030, they look to establish global leadership in the space of artificial intelligence. And their stated aim is to become the center for AI globally. They also, of course, in that report, identify the many strategic applications of AI. And that's the key thing for us to understand, Jim, which is that artificial intelligence is not just one thing. It's not just one vertical area of expertise. It is broad. It underlies much of the scientific discovery, much of the engineering prowess that we will see unfold in the coming years and decades. And this is a capability that is a force multiplier across healthcare, across industry, across military, across policymaking, across finance. And so going back to Putin's statement, while those words sound dire, but I think I can agree with that sentiment. I think having expertise in artificial intelligence will be crucial. And yes, this is a technology that will change the world. In fact, the century that we live in, I refer to this as the AI century. I think AI is going to be the most important driver of change in this century.
Should we be fearful of this?
Well, you know, given how our brains are wired, I don't think we can help it. You know, there's an amygdala in the back of our brain that, you know, triggers that fight or flight response. And here we find ourselves in a situation, the likes of which we have never confronted as the human species. And specifically what I mean by that is that we stand at the cusp, Jim, of being able to now replicate the prowess, the capability of the human mind, even in narrow domains, even to some degree, as machines, as software. And what this means is that we can now rely on these synthetic creations of ours to make decisions that were previously in our ken, in the realm of human decision making.
What are the benefits of this? What advantages will we have based on this revolution?
Well, I think AI is a technology that just broadly magnifies our cognitive potential. If you think about the new innovations, drug discovery, artificial intelligence is being used by some of the largest drug companies to find new kinds of drugs, looking through combinations of molecules that would be very difficult for a human researcher to go through simply because of the scale of that problem. artificial intelligence is being used by some of the largest aviation companies to design structures automatically that reduce weight and improve fuel efficiency. And these are structures that even after 100 years of aviation design, human designers have not been able to come up with. And then I'll give you one more example. In the field of healthcare, on the diagnostic side, AI is being used to scan millions of patient records and abstract common conditions and aspects of those reports that would otherwise escape human attention, and they're aiding diagnostics. So not to make it a long story, of course, in the book, The Sentient Machine, I cover in multiple chapters many examples of such applications, but the applications are broad, varied, and real, and they're happening now.
The book is The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence by Amir Hussein, who is a man, he knows of what he speaks. But is our humanity affected? No matter how expansive the progress is, do we become less human when we rely on artificial intelligence?
That's a great question, and that's basically the core thrust of the book. That's the exploration in the book. And in order to arrive at, I wouldn't say a final answer, but at least enough for people to think about and I think, gain some comfort with, I've fused aspects of philosophy with aspects of science and applications of AI in the real world. And my view of this, Jim, is that, fundamentally we think of ourselves, we define ourselves by what economic labors we perform. And in fact, many of us are named Smith and Goldsmith and Farmer and Miller. These are last names that define us in the context of a profession, something that ends up in, a positive economic labor being performed. But is that really who we are? Is humankind or humanity in some sense related to our ability to perform economic labor? Because in the age of sentient machines, in the age of automation, in the age of AI, when machines start to perform these economic labors, does that mean that if they can do it better, if they can till the fields better, then they are more human than us? I don't think so. I think ultimately we exist to perceive this realm of all possible ideas, this realm of unknown knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is an infinite space. So the arrival of smart machines, I don't think diminishes or takes away from that primary human drive. Which
the book is The Sentient Machine from Amir Hussein, a fascinating man and one of the most important topics of our age. We thank you for joining us, Amir, and we thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Sasha Gabashaw, I'm Jim Inkster.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.